I've never felt like this before. It's like you just get me. I feel like my true self with you. Does that sound crazy? And it doesn't hurt that you're gorgeous. Okay, that's it. I'm taking you home with me. I mean, you can't find shoes this good just anywhere. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
It is Thanksgiving time, 1979. The class of 1983 at Annapolis is gathered to cheer on Navy over Army. I welcome a member of the class of 83, remembering that cold November day, Thomas Modley. His new book about his time in the Navy, both as a midshipman, serving aviator, and later an official at the DOD, is entitled Vectors, Heroes, Villains, and Heartbreak on the Bridge of the U.S. Navy. Tom, you were a young man in 1979. Can you remember that game? What was it like to be a member of all those wonderful young people?
Well, thank you, John, for having me on to talk about the book and to talk about my experiences. 79 was very memorable for me. I had grown up in Cleveland, Ohio, and decided to go to the Naval Academy. At that particular point in our nation's history, it wasn't one of the most popular things to be doing. We were still in somewhat of a Vietnam hangover to some extent in certain parts of the country. And so was very honored to be selected to go there, and always look forward to attending that first Army-Navy game. When we get there as plebes, that first plebe summer, they teach us four important phrases. The first one is yes, sir, then no, sir, and then no excuse, sir. And then the final one is beat Army, sir. And everything that you do as a plebe drives towards that important game that comes in November. Now it comes in December, but at that time it used to come in November around Thanksgiving weekend. And so it's an incredibly important event, I think, in the evolution of your time as a midshipman, because it's really the first time you feel like you're part of something much, much bigger than yourself. And I remember marching into that stadium along with 4,000 or so other midshipmen and standing there and doing the hat trick that we do at the beginning of the game, and just watching that game that had been played for so many decades before, and just really getting an appreciation for what I had become a part of. And it always stuck with me, and it was just a wonderful experience. And of course, Navy won the game running away that particular game. So it was fun in every dimension.
Your mom and dad are from a part of the world that's now in a conflict zone again. It was the Cold War in 1979. We don't know what it's called today, Tom. Where's mom from? Where's dad from?
Sure. My mother was born in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and spent most of her time in Novi Sad. Her mother passed away early, and she had to live in an orphanage with her sister, and her father was then sent off into the German army. So she had a very difficult childhood. There was a big massacre in Novi Sad in 1942, I believe, where people who were suspected of being sympathizers with the opposition to the German army were taken and massacred along the river there in the Danube. And then my father grew up just up the Danube River in Budapest, Hungary. And he escaped after the war in 1948, went to Austria and lived there for a couple of years, and then was able to get passage to the United States. They both settled in Cleveland, Ohio, and they met at an international Hungarian ball in Cleveland, Ohio in 1956.
Your classmates from 1983 went in all directions, surface, submarine. You were an aviator. Where did you do your tours, Tom?
So I immediately after graduation from the academy, I stayed in Washington and did a master's degree at Georgetown in international relations and government, and then joined many of my classmates down in Pensacola, Florida, where I went through flight training for the next year and a half, and then was assigned to an LHA, amphibious assault ship in Norfolk, Virginia, where I flew the ship's company helicopter, UH-1 November helicopter, for a tour. And then because of the master's degree I had, I was selected to go teach at the Air Force Academy as an exchange professor there in their political science department. So I did that for my final years of active duty.
We now move to the 21st century. We leave your 20th century memories behind, Tom. In the 21st century, you are with the Donald Rumsfeld Department of Defense in the early conflict zone that we remember as the War on Terror. What do you remember about Don Rumsfeld? You were Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Financial, well, I wrote down FinTech, forgive me.
Yes, Financial Management. He was one of the Deputy Undersecretaries under the Comptroller, the CFO of the Department of Defense. I had come in originally as the Executive Director of something called the Defense Business Board, which was a board Secretary Rumsfeld established where he brought in CEOs, private sector CEOs, and senior executives from around the country to advise him on this business transformation mission that he was on. That was really the mandate he had coming into the department, was to try and reform and modernize it, given his experience as a private sector CEO. But all that changed, all those priorities changed on September 11th when we were attacked. And the nation and the department basically mobilized to propagate the global war on terror under his leadership from the Department of Defense. However, he continued to cling to the idea that we needed to drive this business reform. And so I was tapped to help do that work.
And you got two important lessons. I wrote them down, Tom. One is you go to war with the army you God, not the army you should have. And the other one, Tom, you can't fix government. What does that refer to, Tom?
Well, that was a familiar mantra. The second one was a familiar mantra that I would hear from people. We were really trying to push the organization to adopt more modern business practices, more modern business systems, improve transparency, be able to get an audit so we'd actually know where the money was going that was being fed to us by the U.S. taxpayers. And there are a lot of systemic things in the department that make it very difficult to drive change like that. And we would frequently hear that phrase like, you know, Tom, you can't fix government or you can't fix this, you know. And so I it was always, to me, it was never discouraging. It was all just kind of like, well, that's just said by people who don't want to try. So we continue to try and push it and made some decent progress in that dimension. The other quote, Secretary Rumsfeld said that because there were questions about how well the war was going, whether or not we had the right equipment there. This is the Iraq war. And he said, hey, look, we go to war with the army we have, not the army we wish we had. And it's true. I think people took that as a sort of sarcastic criticism of the state of the army or of the military in general. But it's very, very true, because you only have what you have. And if you're thinking about the world through certain paradigms, you're going to build what you think you need for that. But my argument was, when I returned later, was that the paradigm we should be thinking about is unpredictability. And so that, I believe, suggests a very different type of force that's much more agile, much more mobile, much more flexible, responsive, et cetera. And I think he believed that too back then. But events have a way of taking over the agenda. And when the terrorist attacks happened, he really got focused on that. And so some of those efforts sort of died on the vine.
Your professional life then included Price Waterhouse until 2017, when the Navy suffers two tragedies, the Fitzgerald collision and the McCain collision. At the same time, you are under consideration to be Undersecretary of the Navy. You got a phone call from the Trump administration. Are you interested?
Thanks, John. So initially, I was not interested. I really had not been active in politics, but I did start hearing some things in the early part of 2017 that they were having a hard time finding people, because several very prominent national security specialists had signed this Never Trump letter. And of course, the president was not anxious to bring any of those people onto his staff. But in a normal change of administration to a Republican administration, those people would have been some of the most aggressive at trying to get jobs. And I was not interested in being aggressive to try and get one of those jobs. I liked the job I had and felt like I could continue to do that for several more years. But I did receive a call from the White House personnel office in the Pentagon, and they asked me if I was interested. And I told them bluntly that I was, but only if a couple of jobs were available. And one of them was the Undersecretary of the Navy. And so it was offered, and I accepted.
I mentioned the McCain and Fitzgerald because that represents the challenge to anybody going into the Navy secretaryship these days, is that the fleet is overextended and not strong enough to do all the missions it must in order to maintain freedom of the seas. And we will address that now, because in late 2019, Tom gets another call. The Secretary of the Navy has left his post, Mr. Spencer, and that means Tom is going to be acting Secretary of the Navy. And when we come back, what does that mean as we end 2019 and move into 2020? China threat, pandemic threat. The book is Vectors, Heroes, Villains, and Heartbreak on the Bridge of the U.S. Navy. Thomas B. Modley is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.